welcome to the Sexier Than a Squirrel podcast, where games-based training is the groundbreaking foundation for achieving real-life results in your dog training. We're all about innovative and fun methods to train and connect with our dogs. And today, we have a special treat for all our listeners. We're joined by Laura DeMeo Roy, a service dog trainer who has transformed the lives of countless individuals and their dogs through her exceptional training techniques. Laura brings a wealth of knowledge and experience to the table, and she's here to share her insights on how service dogs are trained to assist and empower their handlers in everyday life. These dogs are more than just pets. They are lifelines. So grab your leash and your dog and settle in as we dive into this fascinating conversation with Laura DeMeo Roy. It's a discussion you won't want to miss. Let's get started.
Yeah, absolutely. So hi, I'm Laura from Doggy You, and I have been working with service dogs for about a decade and a half now. I started out as a guide dog mobility instructor. So I was training guide dogs for the blind through a small organization that did exclusively German Shepherd guide dogs. And then I branched out into doing my own business, including helping owner trainers train their own service dogs. I also was a guide dog placement specialist, and now I do a lot of different educational resources surrounding service dogs for those people that are interested in owner training their service dog.
Wow, that's amazing. So in terms of, you know, do you have any stories, Laura, that show the incredible work a service dog can do for a person?
Oh, yes. Quite a few. I have a kind of an interesting one that in the field of guide dogs, I had a client who was using their guide dog. So what guide dogs do, let me take a step back, is they are responsible for taking someone safely from point A to point B. So the human knows where they're going and the dog is responsible for getting them there safely, not knocking into things, stopping at curbs, all of that. I had a client at one point who told me this story about him working his guide dog, and he went out on his normal everyday route and he was supposed to go down the sidewalk to a particular location, and his dog just would not go forward. And they're trained in something called intelligent disobedience, or what I call superseding cues. So basically, if it's unsafe to execute the cue that the handler is asking them for, they don't do it or they do something differently. And in this case, the dog would not go forward. And so the guy was like, all right, there's something going on. I'm going to turn around and go home. He takes his wife out with him afterwards, and there is an alligator laying across the sidewalk that the dog was protecting him from stepping on. So, that's kind of a silly one, but also like an incredible like move by the dog to make sure that the handler was safe.
Yeah. I mean, that's an amazing level of discernment there.
And
knowing that that's quite dangerous. Say anyone in our audience, myself, if we're out and about, Laura, how should we interact with a service dog if we see one in public?
That's such a great question. And the answer is you shouldn't. So you want to think about a service dog like any other piece of medical equipment when you're thinking about how you might interact with them. And you wouldn't go up to someone's cane and touch it, or, touch someone's wheelchair or any other medical device. So the same thing goes with service dogs. And I know it's so hard because they are so adorable. But the more that you can keep your distance, give the handler and the dog space and ignore them, and be sure to also talk to the handler and not talk to the dog. We get a lot when we're working in the field where people will stare at the dog and they'll be like, I can't touch you, or, oh my goodness, you're so creepy, but I can't distract you. And that in itself is incredibly distracting for dogs, of course. Now, we train them so that they don't, react to those things, but it'll help, especially new handlers, if you completely ignore the dog and, talk to the person just like they're a person if you do need to interact with them. And if you have your dog with you, give them lots of space, keep your dog on a short leash. And if you're in a store, say it's a pet friendly store, go ahead and take a different aisle if you need to. And that's especially true of guide dogs, where they might not be able to see you and they can't give you space.
Right. So, and I mean, that might even include not letting your dog stare at them as well, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, again, the dogs are trained to a high level, but they're also just dogs. So the more they have these difficult interactions, the harder it is for them and for the handler as well.
Well, and how detrimental could it be to a service dog handler if their dog does have a negative experience with another dog?
Yeah, there's a couple of different things that happen because people always ask that. And the one with just the other, I want to just point out the one if they have human experiences that are difficult is the dog can start paying attention more to the human. So say you like call out to the dog and it's right before a staircase and the dog is supposed to stop for the staircase and they get momentarily distracted. That's a huge risk for the handler. And then as far as dogs, I've had dogs that have to be retired because they've been attacked by other dogs. So, you know, there's a dog on a flexi leash in a store. It comes around the corner without the handler, attacks the dog, and the dog can no longer be used for service work. And that means an investment that could represent $40,000, $50,000, $60,000 of, you know, worth for that person is gone, as well as a dog that now has to be, you know, potentially rehabilitated from that and may not come back for it enough for service work.
Just going back to your story about the dog with the alligator.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Like, and there's, you know, like I said, the training is high level, but when you're talking about these brand new service dog teams, that can be really challenging, especially you get a young dog and a handler that's brand new and they're not perfect right off the bat. So we want to give them as much grace as we can, know that they are dogs first, and then give them space and, you know, lots of space around you and your dog.
We're talking about service dogs, but there's also guide dogs. How is this different from a service dog? Are there any different rules around it?
Yeah, so they're all under the general broad category and protections of service dog when we're talking about the law. However, there are some different considerations for guide dogs specifically in that they cannot create space for you. Their handler may or may not be able to see you because blindness is a spectrum. Not everybody who's using a guide dog is, you know, completely or totally blind. A lot of people have some amount of vision and use guide dogs. However, you know, the more space that you can give them, and then just the thoughts around, like, a lot of people will want to help someone who has a guide dog and they want to like touch them or like grab their arm or do things like that. Please don't do that. You know, if you see a person that you think might need some help, ask them and ask them in the way that they want to be helped. You know, ask them how they would like to be helped. But most people who are out using guide dogs, you talking to them, especially around traffic, is more distracting than them so that they can't focus on what they need to do, which is listen for traffic to get across the street safely.
Right, so exactly. Let the dog do their job.
Yeah. Yep. Pretty much.
So what type of dogs make good service dogs, Laura?
That is a huge topic, but I'll give you kind of a brief overview on that. We want to look at each dog as an individual, of course, and there are lots of different breeds that can make great service dogs. And also, I work in statistics and numbers. Right. So my goal, especially when I'm working with owner trainers, is I want them to have the highest possible chance of success for them and their dog. So when I'm giving advice about that, I'm looking at, can we, you know, get, usually I'm recommending bench bred labs. So there's a reason that pretty much every service dog organization, at least in the United States and mostly across the world too, is using labs and Goldens as their primary dogs, lab Golden Crosses, some poodles, some will use German Shepherds, but they're generally a lower success rate. So when you're looking at service dog stuff, I can't give specific recommendations for each person, but my broad recommendation is look at a well-bred Labrador with a history of service dogs in the lines, especially service dogs that you need, because each service dog might be a bit different between like a psych dog or a mobility dog. You know, all of those are just slightly different.
And depending on the role they're meant to play, that would kind of have an impact on what personality traits or what kind of temperament they have.
Yes. Yep. Yeah. So when we're talking about matching dogs, there's a lot that goes into that. But just like you think with your pet dogs, right? You want to think about lifestyle, how much exercise you're already getting right now, and matching a dog to those things. And then another thing that's really important is pace. So a lot of times the conflict that arises from leash walking skills, the same way that it arises with pet dogs, is that we've got a mismatch of pace. And that's much more important when we're talking about things like service dogs, where they're going to have to be in a heel position for a long period of time. So we want to try and get a dog that functions well at the human pace. It's actually the number one thing that they match guide dogs on is pace, because we need to, it's hard to modify a dog's pace long-term.
Wow. That's really cool. I have no idea.
But yeah, personality matters too, of course. But you know, when we're looking at dogs, we want to think about, lifestyle first, and then task training is depending on what the task training is, it can be secondary because the lifestyle match is so, so important.
Right. If they're incompatible, it's not going to work.
Right.
So Laura, can you walk us through, and I know I'm asking you big questions and we're getting, can you walk us through the training process for a service dog from puppyhood to certification?
Yeah, there's kind of two tracks that we're talking about here. So one would be program raise and train dogs. And one would be if you're owner training, which would be you're getting the puppy yourself and working, or potentially an adult dog and working through a process to get to full service dog training. So with program trained dogs, you know, every program is different, but generally the puppies are going to be typically born in house. So bred and born in house. And then they're going to go out to a puppy raiser from usually 8 weeks until early adulthood, late adolescence. So somewhere around 14 to 16 months, they come back into formal training. They do formal training anywhere from 3 to 9 months or so, and then they are matched with a human. So that's a general program dog life. And then with owner trainers, that process, you know, we haven't talked a lot about the laws, and I know that, you know, the people listening are from all different countries, but I'm from the United States and that's my specialty and that's the laws that I know. And here there's no certification process. So the ADA is what governs the United States. So Americans with Disabilities Act, which was passed in the 1990s. And there is no certification process. However, I always recommend that you use more objective testing to test to see where your service dog is at in training and where you might need more help. So you might find a well-bred dog that's raised well, and then you're going to bring that puppy home and you're going to focus a lot on socialization when they're young because you can't get that time back. So big focus on socialization, getting them out for new experiences. And then you might work towards something like a canine good citizen test. I know there's kind of comparable tests all over the world, but you know, it's a pet test that you can use to say, okay, if I can pass this CGC, then my dog is on the right track towards service work. So that's my low bar for it, like my minimum bar. And then we start working towards more challenging tests like the canine community canine, CGCA, and the urban canine, CGCU, where you're going to pass these progressively more challenging tests. And they're all an opportunity for you to assess where your dog is. And then once you get through those testings, you can do a public access test. Again, none of this is required in the United States, but it is required in other countries. There's some form of certification required in some countries. And many programs will have some type of culminating tests at the end of the program. You know, like when I was doing guide dogs, there were 9 tests, 3 major tests over the course of the training.
Yeah. So for anyone listening, definitely check out your country's laws and regulations and things like that. This is definitely, like Laura said, she's from the US. So a lot of things that she's stating is from that experience. So Laura, in terms of, you know, owner handler, you said that would look quite different in terms of against a program dog and their process. And it would vary probably just by the needs of the owner handler, right?
Yeah. It depends on your resources. Yeah. So depending on the experience level of the person, I don't know many owner trainers that don't use some sort of professional training, whether that be group classes or private training, or like, you know, I did a lot of online training for people across the country. There is a severe lack of qualified service dog trainers in the United States right now, and probably all over the world. So sometimes people are finding resources outside of their immediate area. Just because you're owner training doesn't mean you're not getting help. Just like a pet dog person might go to classes. I personally am a trainer who I'm getting a puppy next year. I will be going to classes with my dog because it's a great opportunity for that dog to practice their skills around a captive audience of other dogs.
Right. Like, so public access and ignoring things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that, you know, can you work around all of these very difficult distractions? Yeah.
So how do the needs of a person with disabilities, how do they shape the training of their service dog? I know we're pivoting here.
Yeah. No. That would be the task training function of the dog. And every disability is different. You know, I've worked with people with so many types of disabilities, and we're finding more and more ways that a dog can be helpful with people with disabilities. And the tasks that you train can be really specific. And a lot of times when you're owner training, you may start out and say, I want to train my dog to retrieve medication on an alarm at this particular time. And then you start training and you're like, actually, I can just ask my dog to retrieve the medication. I don't need to do it on this specific skill set or whatever. As you start training your dog, you'll find tasks that you want to add to your training and then tasks that you might be like, oh, I thought I was going to use this, but I'm not using it as much as I thought I would, kind of thing. But yeah, the disability shapes what the dog does, but the overall need to be well-behaved and have good public access skills is across the board.
Perfect. And so what are some common misconceptions about service dogs that you might want to address on this podcast, Laura?
So one of the big ones we already mentioned is certification. In the United States, there is not a certification requirement under the ADA. And so, you know, that is a question I get asked a lot. The other one that is big is the idea that the service dog never gets to be a dog. I get those questions a lot, like, oh, it's so sad that they have to work all the time. I'm like, they love, like, a dog that is well matched for service work loves to go out with their handler, get to be with them all day long, get reinforced for the tasks they're doing. And then when they go home and they take their vests off, you know, they get to kayak and hike and do all the things that a regular dog gets to do. They just have this other enriching part of their life that they follow their handler around for. And of course, that's not without stress, but they do get to be dogs. Like, the difference between my personal service dog in vest and out is like night and day. It's like party time when she's off the clock and all business when she puts the vest on. And then the last one that is a huge misconception is that any dog can be a service dog. These dogs that we are working with are the astronauts of the field. They have to have stable temperaments. They have to deal with so much on a daily basis. And it takes a particular dog to be successful at that and to not get overly stressed or not be frightened of all of the things that we are asking them to do. So it's not that you can train any dog to do this work. And that's really, really important to understand. And that doesn't make it a bad dog if they're not appropriate for service work. It just makes them a really nice pet or potentially really nice for another type of job.
Right. So their handler really does have to be or is sexier than a squirrel.
Yes. Yeah, definitely squirrels will be out there. Then you're going to have to be able to ignore them. Squirrels, kids carrying little toys around, trying to feed your dog hot dogs, all the things.
Exactly. So we touched base. You said, you know, we touched base on whether legally, is there a certification for a service dog? What are the legal protections for service dogs and their handlers?
Yeah, I won't get too deep into it because there's, you know, quite a bit of law surrounding service dogs. But generally in the United States, a service dog can go any public place that the general public would be allowed, with some limited exceptions. You know, one of them I can think of is like certain parts of zoos or certain parts of national parks where it might affect the other animals or the dog is in danger, or Disney World, right? That you might not be able to bring them on all the rides, even though you can go in Disney. So yeah, they're allowed to go generally anywhere that their human would be allowed to go in public. There's also some housing. So the ADA covers a certain section. There's some housing things. So the Fair Housing Act covers another portion of what service dogs are allowed to do. And then there's some employment law as well. But generally, they get to go where you get to go.
Looking back at the history you've had and you've worked with organizations and everything, so what are the emotional impacts on a trainer when a service dog is paired with a person and you have to say goodbye?
I know I get this asked so often, and I think the answer will be a little bit surprising, but like, I'm thrilled when they get paired with their person. I mean, don't get me wrong. The first string of dogs, like guide dogs that I trained and went out, I bawled my eyes out when they left to go to their people. However, you know that they're going, especially program dogs, you know that they're going from this training process that can be really challenging. And they're one of, you know, five or six dogs on a string to getting their person who's going to love on them and they're going to dote on them and they're going to get to go with them everywhere. I'm happy for the dogs. And I also, you know, what does affect my opinion on this is my dad is blind and he is actually one of the first guide dogs that I trained was his first guide dog. So I've seen the impact that these dogs can have on others when they're matched. So yes, like selfishly, it's a little sad, but also, you know, they're going where they're supposed to be and doing the things they're supposed to do.
I love that perspective. So in terms of for our audience, just kind of breaking down a few things, because there are different types of jobs for different dogs and what they do. What is the difference? And I know this is a big question, but what is the difference between emotional support animals, therapy dogs, and service dogs?
Yeah. And I should point out that because the audience is international, that in a lot of other countries, they're going to call service dogs assistance dogs. So the language around this may be US specific. So that's just a caveat before I start talking about this. But service dogs, they're task trained to a high level and they have public access rights. Okay. So that's what defines our service dog. And they're trained for an individual person to mitigate their disability. Okay. ESAs, no training requirements. They provide therapeutic benefits. So emotional support, companionship, comfort, just by existing to help someone with a psychiatric or mental health disability. They can be any animal, whereas service dogs can be dogs and in the caveat of also miniature horses. So your ESAs can be more animals outside of dogs. They're covered under the Fair Housing Act and they don't perform specific tasks. So their presence relieves the symptoms for the person instead of the task that they're trained to do. They also do not have public access rights in most places. Now, it's funny because certain states can have different laws. It's very complicated in the US, but generally overarching federal law, ESAs are not covered under the ADA. And then therapy dogs, and this admittedly is not my specialty because they are very different than service dogs, but they provide comfort and support for people in nursing homes, hospitals, et cetera. They don't have any public access rights and are only allowed in public places when they're invited. So just because you have a certified therapy dog or a therapy dog doesn't mean you could just bring them into Target when you go into Target. They are not covered under laws to be able to have public access rights. Most of them do require training, though, and a lot of times in the U.S., you need to pass some type of test within an organization to be part of that therapy dog organization. But again, not my specialty, so that I'm doing my best on that one.
Thank you. So in terms of, I know we did talk about that the common breeds were labs and bench bred labs and golden retrievers, I think you mentioned as well, and poodles in some instances. Now, are there any breeds that you feel most of the time are not typical for, I know there are exceptions, but are not suitable for service dog work? Or is it more about individual dogs' characteristics?
Now you're having me step into dangerous territory here. So what I will say is that you want to look at what the breed was originally bred for when you're considering the type of breed. And I know everybody wants the cool looking dog and they don't want the quote unquote boring lab, though labs are not boring. But we want to look at function and form instead of breed. So the reason that a lot of these gun bred dogs work well is because they were bred for many years to work with a handler, retrieve to hand, which is something that so many people that are training their dog for a particular task need, you know, whether it's medication retrieve, picking up things that they've dropped, retrieving a leash off the ground. When you have a dog that has that innate skill, it's much easier to train. And when you're dealing with a disability, that you want to make things easier for yourself. You don't need to make them harder for yourself. The other misconception a lot of times that I get, especially for psychiatric service dogs, is that people want a dog that's very emotionally in tune with them. I don't want that in most scenarios. So I want a dog that's more like walking around and like, say you get nervous when you go into a grocery store and you want your dog to be like, huh, Laura's being pretty nervous right now. All right, let's go into Target. No big deal. Yeah. Like you want a dog that's like, she's weird. Let's go. That's what you're looking for, because you can get like, especially like some herding dogs can get this very negative feedback loop where the dog's like, oh, and it doesn't have to be herding dogs, but you know, a lot of times this will come up, is the dog's like, oh, my handler is nervous in these situations. Should I be nervous in these situations? And that's what we don't want for some particular disabilities.
Yeah. So, and the other thing maybe would be if they have a breed that is rare or not common, mm-hmm. that it actually might bring more attention to them than they want, right?
Tell me about it. Yeah. So I, personal experience with this, I have an Australian Coolie as my service dog. She was not purchased for that role. And I do not recommend them for service work. So I want to just put that out there. She's also a very fun Merle color with yellow eyes. And the amount of times I get asked about her is like detrimental to my ability to walk through the world and get the things done that I need to get done. There, you know, I will be getting one of the top breeds for my next service dog. And part of that reason is because everyone who talks to you thinks that their question is novel, but you know, I might get asked the same thing 5 times and I'm just trying to go to the grocery store to buy broccoli. So having, like, as much as it shouldn't be an issue, having rare breeds will cause more public interaction than some people would like.
Laura, and I've met Cool Whip. I think she's amazing. Also would probably want to say hi to her.
So she's very cute.
Yeah. But again, self-control. So how do you handle a situation where maybe service dog's in training? And I guess this would go into the two paths, right? There's the owner handler and then the program. But how would you handle if they didn't meet the requirements or the standards? And
yeah,
what would be some things that would put them in that position?
Yeah, great question. So I'll start with the program style first, because it's an easier one to answer. So in a program, there's a variety of tests typically throughout the program to decide if the dog is going to be a good fit for the type of service work that they're training them to do. And if they aren't a good fit, they're typically what we call career changed, or some people will call it washed out. But we like to say career changed because it's nicer. And they may be suitable for another job. You know, I've had, German Shepherds, not all of them are appropriate for guide work. So, you know, some of them will go to like detection work, police work, or they might go on to another type of service work that just isn't the service work that the organization does. So that's where program dogs will go, career changed. And then for owner trainers, that's where I like using these more standardized tests to help not make it the decision of the trainer or the handler as much. It's like, okay, we've practiced for this test. We've tried it a couple times. The dog just really isn't happy doing this work, because we want to really look at, is the dog going to be happy doing the work? And then, you know, they may stay as a pet for that family. They may go to another family member, and, you know, we can help the person find a more suitable candidate. But it is a risk with owner training. It really is, because, you know, like I said, it's very hard to get good service dog stock to then train up to be a service dog. You know, it's a difficult challenge.
Well, and honestly, I think I think owner handlers, if they're not quite sure what path to take, and it's not always easy to figure that out, there's a lot of information out there that could lead them in the wrong direction.
I think that's true. And I think the other reason that a lot of people will owner train as opposed to get to a program dog is the wait lists are long to get a program dog, and they can be quite a big investment. But I want to caution people that finding the right dog, training it up, and all of the training that you may have to invest in for that dog and potentially that dog not working out is also a high, not only monetary investment, but personal investment. Because when you're set on a dog working out and it's just not the right dog for the job, it can be really, really emotionally draining.
Can service dogs be trained to help with non-traditional tasks? And what would be an example of that that maybe Cool Whip does?
Yeah. So it's hard to parse out what is traditional versus non-traditional, because I've worked with such a variety of disabilities and a variety of tasks. I thought of one kind of funny one that might be, a good illustration, but because I worked in guide dogs, you know, guide dogs are going to do their business, and you need to pick up that business and you need to put it somewhere. And so one of the tasks I've trained periodically is finding a trash can. So the dog will go and find the trash can to throw the poop out in, which is a fun one. I've taught dogs to target things like light poles. So if someone needs to cross a street mid-block, they might need to target a light pole so they know where they're going. As far as the things that Cool Whip does, we do a medication retrieve, leg shaking, like your dog can interrupt Either behaviors that are precursors to other behaviors like panic attacks, or things that you're not noticing. And when the dog points them out to you, then you can go into whatever your protocol is for that situation for you. So sometimes you can use a dog to point out your physical state so that you can go into your repertoire of other tools that you have during those situations to help yourself out. Or the dog can do something like deep pressure therapy. So you're edging towards a panic attack or an anxiety situation, and the dog can put pressure on your chest, put pressure over your lap, and help out your nervous system that way. But I've also taught some non-traditional grounding tasks. So say someone doesn't like the feel or the contact from the dog, but they really need to be grounded into the moment. You can teach them the dog to stand in front of you and step on your feet and kind of connect you to your present moment, and bring you back to where you are. Or things like we can make the dog look like they're alerting that they need to go to the bathroom, but you really just need to leave a social situation. And so the dog can do nose boops and be like, hey, I can see that your physical state has changed. Maybe you're picking your nails or pulling your hair or doing something like that. But to the public, it's a graceful way to exit. The dog starts alerting to it and you're like, oh, they have to go to the bathroom. And then they guide you out of the store.
Are there certain things, or I guess jobs, that can't necessarily be trained? Like it's something that a dog has to intuitively know how to do. It just cannot be trained.
Yeah. So this is actually... the science is not keeping up what we're able to get the dogs to do at this point. So it's a little bit of touchy territory, I suppose. Things like migraine alerting, right? All of the training on that is relatively new in the last whatever years that it's being popularized. And a lot of it is scent-based work, but we're not 100% sure what the dogs are actually alerting to. So we used to feel like seizure dogs needed to, so a dog that can alert to a seizure was an innate ability. And it sometimes would run in lines of dogs, but now we're finding out, and I cautiously here, that there are some things that we might be able to train for that we hadn't previously thought we could train for. But the science is not there yet. So whenever we think about, like, if you're thinking you would like a dog to alert to a particular state, what I want to say is you should not get a dog thinking that it will be able to do that. However, any dog can respond. So for instance, if it's seizure, response, the dog may not be able to alert to the seizure, but they may be they can most typically be trained to go get help, bring medication, do deep pressure therapy, elevate your leg, whatever it is that you need them to do. So we want to go into it thinking we can pretty much generally create a response dog, but we're not always going to be able to create a dog that can alert to a particular thing, especially if that thing is not physical manifested physically. And also the science is changing and service dogs in this capacity with so many different kinds of dogs is we're just scratching the surface of what these dogs can do. So I'm super hopeful that we're going to have the science to back up what people are finding, in the next decade or so.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Disclaimer.
Anecdotally, we have some information, but I want to be clear that science is important. So
I do know of instances where service dog handlers have run into some public access issues, and because of just the public not being informed. Mm-hmm. So how can businesses and public facilities where service dogs are able to go, how can they better accommodate service dogs and their handlers?
What I will say is, like I said, I've been in this game or this industry for the last decade and a half. And when I first started, the access issues were constant. The education just was not there. So I dealt with it a lot. And that lack of education has gotten a lot better over time. So that in itself is very hopeful. It's not where it needs to be, but you're not running into the problems that you used to have. That being said, if you're a business, some of the things that you can do is first know the laws of your country. So in the US, you can ask two questions to a person if it's not readily apparent why they have a service dog. So you can ask them, is the dog a service animal required because of a disability? And what work or task has the dog been trained to perform? So those are the two questions you ask. Know them, write them down if you need to, so that you can legally ask the things that you need to. But if it's apparent why the dog is there or the dog isn't, there's no issues, leave the person alone. So the next thing is be sure that your building is up to code. So people with disabilities, like they run into so many access issues related to just accessibility. So making sure that your accessible stall is available so that a person who has a dog or, you know, other large medical equipment has a place to go to the bathroom. Make sure that your accessible equipment is working. I can't tell you how many times that I've gone to a movie theater and the voiceover, the audio that's supposed to be available to, you know, like when I go with my dad who's blind, just doesn't work. And so now we're at a movie theater and he doesn't have the same access to the movie as other people. And some people don't even know that that is even a thing, you know, that they have. And if you're a shop owner, this is a big one, and you let your dog roam loose in the shop, this can be a huge hazard to service dogs. And people don't think of it, especially in pet shops. But if you own a store, your dog is loose, consider gating them behind the desk so that people have equal access to be able to shop in your store. Because I know personally, there are some stores that I will not shop in because I don't know if my service dog is going to be attacked going into them. And generally the dogs are friendly, but you have no idea. And I cannot risk that with my service dog.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Because it's just the consequence is just.
Yeah, it's too high. The risk is too high.
Yeah. What advice do you have for families maybe considering a service dog for a child with disabilities?
Yeah. So I will say working with children is not my specialty. So I say that in that a lot of people think that all service dog trainers do all the things. And I personally don't. So my specialties include guide dog work, mobility work, and psych dogs. So that's why I'm not as up on the scent stuff that we were talking about before, because that's not a specialty that I have. So working with children, I've done it a couple of times in the school systems. But you know, you want to get your information from someone who does this type of thing full time. And also, if I had to give advice to someone with a child looking for a service dog, the first thing I would say is generally consider purchasing an already trained dog or going through a program. It's very difficult to raise any child. And then also to train a dog to the standard that is required of service dog work, it throws many families. Like they are not like the amount of families that have thought they're going to own or train their own service dog and then throw in the towel within 6 months is pretty high. So if you can get an already trained dog, that will be best for you. If your child's going to be the primary handler of the dog, consider whether they're ready for like a difficult responsibility, especially socially. Bringing a dog to school is very, very, very hard for the human child because all the kids want to pet them. You know, there's a lot going on there. And then for very young children, does the child actually want a dog?
That's a big question.
Well, I've run into a lot where the parent wants the dog to fix, quote unquote, fix, which is not a thing, but wants the dog to come in and help the child, but the child actively dislikes dogs or is indifferent to the dog. So if your child already has like a special interest in animals, that's a great sign, but make sure like the hard part is the dog isn't going to come in and make everything easier. It might make some things easier, but it's going to make a lot of things harder. So you want to weigh the pros and cons quite a bit before delving into that. And the best thing that you can do is if you already have a pet dog, start training that pet dog. And this goes across the board, not just for people with children. Start training that pet dog. See how much you like it. Because when you want to owner train your own service dog, you have to become, you know, a little trainer yourself. So you need to be really committed to the process. And if you're not interested in training the dog that you already have, it's going to be a slog to train a service dog to completion.
Right. And having that little bit of experience with your pet dog will certainly help you navigate and maybe work through some things first.
Oh, yeah. You know, when I started doing this and I started getting asked to do dogs outside of guide dogs, you know, so, you know, more than 10 years ago, there wasn't a lot of resources online. People weren't making YouTube videos about how to train your service dog. So what I did is I took my pet dog and I practiced everything and I made up training protocols for myself for how to train specific things. And I worked them all out on the dog that I had before I ever brought them out into the public. And that's how you can kind of work through things before you get the real thing, if that makes sense, because you're going to make mistakes the first time you do something and you're going to figure out better ways to do it. You know, there's a lot more resources now than there was a decade ago, but start training your pet dog. And also that will benefit the new dog that comes in as well.
Right. Because either way, either even if you have a program dog or your owner handler, then they're still maintaining the training.
Yeah. Yep. Exactly. Right. Yeah. And before you bring in another dog, you want to have the dog that you already have trained. That will make your life so much easier.
What happens to service dogs that are no longer able to do their job?
Sure. There's a lot of different things that might happen. The first and most common one is that the dog is just retired and stays with the family, and that is, or with the person. And that's pretty common. However, there are situations where someone might be in housing that doesn't allow for pets, where they're not going to be able to keep their dog. And that's a really tough challenge. However, usually in those situations, the dog is either going to go to a close friend or family member where they can see the person sometimes. Or if they don't have someone that can take the retired dog, then they'll go back to, typically for a program, they're going to go back to the program. And there's a long list of applications for people who want these retired dogs. So they're always going to end up in good hands. It just matters the person's situation. And honestly, retiring one dog and starting a new dog by yourself in the home is very challenging. So, you know, sometimes it's the best situation, even if the retired dog goes to another friend or family member for a couple weeks while you start bonding with the new dog.
Yeah. Do you find that a retired dog in a household can sometimes be a bit confused by another dog doing tasks and things like that?
It really depends. Every situation is different. Some of the dogs, when you retire them, they're like, great, now I'm a couch dog and I sit at home. Dogs are much more adaptable than we are and more than we wake them out to be. So they typically, you know, will understand their new role. And owner trainers who are transitioning to a new dog, usually that transition is pretty gradual. So they might be using their current dog for the 2 to 3 years it's going to take them to train up the younger dog. And the younger dog is going to gain so much from having that role model for them. So it's not typically a huge challenge past the first week or two.
How long does a service dog work typically? And then what is the typical retirement age?
Yeah. So let me start with how long it takes to train one so that you kind of get the whole vibe. So typically it's going to take 2 to 3 years to fully train a service dog. My goalpost is 3 years. Typically at 3 years, I've got a dog that's not only trained, but seasoned. And that's a whole different thing. You know, at 2 years old, the dog may have the skills, but they haven't applied them in such a variety of situations. So we're talking about a 2 to 3 year old dog that's going to be fully trained and starting working. And then the retirement age depends a lot on the dog, the size of the dog / the lifespan of the dog. There's some dogs that have worked until 14 years old until they pass away. And they're just happy to keep doing their job. And there's some dogs that slow down around 8 or 9 years old. And the person is like, okay, this dog is ready for retirement. Or the person has more needs, like they need to be able to go and do more things. And the dog just isn't capable of keeping up at that point, and they're ready to be retired at that time. So the range is pretty large.
In terms of how service dog training has changed over the years, where do you see it going in the future?
Yeah. So a couple of different things. Like I said, there's better access to information, which is excellent. You know, less denials, more people that understand what's going on. There's been a big push towards positive reinforcement dog training. So I've personally seen a huge shift in the industry. You know, that's not across the board, of course, but you're seeing more and more applications of positive reinforcement based dog training in the service dog industry. There's also more owner trainers. So the more that we discover that dogs can help us in all these various ways, there will be more service dogs out in the world. So training to a high standard is super, super important because you're only going to see more of them. And to that point, there are not enough qualified trainers. that are doing this work. So I'm hoping that there will be more people and more avenues towards being able to become a service dog trainer in the future.
So if someone was interested in making it their career, Laura, how would they go about doing that?
Yeah, there's a lot of different paths to that. What I would say, you know, there's a lot of book paths, so like school paths, that kind of thing. And all of that is excellent. And I highly recommend not only, you know, primary education, but continuing education on the subject. I think that's incredibly important. And also, you have to get your hands on dogs. The more, like, if in an ideal world, the path looks like I, you know, start working with, you know, maybe I'm volunteering at, you know, at a humane society or something like that, where I'm just doing pet dog training, putting my hands on a bunch of dogs, working with them. Then I might start volunteering for an organization. So an organization that is nearby, I can go and maybe walk the dogs, participate in the puppy classes, do that kind of thing. A lot of organizations are going to hire from within because they already have experience with you. So, and that was my path, is I was volunteering at the guide dog school and then they hired me as an apprentice. If you can get an apprenticeship, it will help you so much. Learning from a variety of people and from a variety of dogs will very much inform and make you a better trainer overall. So if you can get in with an organization or even under a single trainer where you can apprentice with them or learn from them, that is one of the best ways to go about it, I think.
Well, Laura, I have thoroughly enjoyed talking to you today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, no, this was absolutely very fun. So thank you for having me.
And that wraps up another fantastic episode of the Sexier Than a Squirrel podcast. It's been an enlightening conversation, and we hope it has inspired you as much as it has inspired us. Remember, the bond between a service dog and their handler is more than just companionship. It's a lifeline built on trust, training, and a deep mutual understanding. Today's discussion with Laura has highlighted just how transformative a well-trained service dog can be in someone's life. If you're intrigued by the power of games-based training or considering a service dog for yourself or a loved one, we encourage you to explore further. There's a world of possibilities out there, and as we've learned today, the right training can make all the difference. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast for more engaging talks and innovative training tips. We're here to keep you entertained and informed on all things dog training, one game at a time.